Pardon me. Whoops. That's what the president's hearing today. Pardon me. Everybody is trying to get pardons and commutations. Today is the last full day of the presidency of Donald Trump. He will grant pardons. Does he have the power to do so? You'll hear why on The Dirt Show. Today is the last full day of President Trump's term as President of the United States. Tomorrow he becomes Citizen Trump. And it's expected that today he will exercise one of the few powers that the president can exercise alone, without the consent of Congress, without the advice of the Justice Department. The president, under the Constitution, and I'll quote, shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. In other words, the president cannot pardon himself or anyone else who is being impeached, but he can pardon anyone, presumably including himself, from any offenses against the United States, whether offenses that have already been prosecuted or offenses that are to be prosecuted in the future. It has to be offenses that have been committed. You can't pardon somebody for future crimes, although Jefferson came awfully close to trying to do that during the Aaron Burr trial. He called potential witnesses into his office and made them a deal, the president of the United States sitting and making a deal. If you will testify against Aaron Burr, I will give you a pardon, which is basically a form of immunity. But if you don't testify against him, we will prosecute you. Not Jefferson's finest hour. Jefferson was obsessed with the need to prosecute and convict Aaron Burr, not because he killed Hamilton, but because he tried to arrange an army in the South, maybe to come up and take over the United States. It was always very questionable. Jefferson reportedly told his cousin, Chief Justice John Marshall, that unless he got a conviction for Aaron Burr, he, Jefferson, would move to impeach Chief Justice Marshall. Well, that didn't happen. The jury acquitted in a strange acquittal. They didn't say not guilty. They said not proven, the Scottish verdict. Burr tried to change that to not guilty. Marshall wouldn't do that. It's one of the great cases and trials of American history, and it ended indecisively, as some trials often do. But it really shows you the depth and power of the president to engage in granting pardons. And all presidents grant pardons on their last day in office. President Obama pardoned over 300 people in his last week in office. President Clinton pardoned several people, some controversially, literally on the morning of January 20th. And we can anticipate that there will be pardons. Some of the newspapers have reported approximately 100 pardons. I have no idea whether that's true or not. And that would be within the mainstream. Less than Obama, more than Clinton, within the mainstream of pardons granted. Let me make a prediction here. The president will not pardon himself. He will not pardon members of his family. He will not pardon, I think, Rudy Giuliani. I think none of these people would want pardons because a pardon does imply guilt. Now, you don't have to accept a pardon. A pardon is granted. You have no choice whether you're accepting it or not. You can't say, I want to stay in jail. I refuse to accept the pardon. The Supreme Court has held that. But nonetheless, getting a pardon or even a commutation does suggest some degree of guilt. And I don't think that's something that the president or his family members would want. They would probably prefer to fight this out in court. Some arguments have said, no, the president's not going to pardon himself. And they give an absurd reason, because if he does, he won't claim the Fifth Amendment. The president's not going to claim the Fifth Amendment. Presidents don't claim the Fifth Amendment. I don't think we're going to see President Trump saying, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me. But absurd arguments abound. You know, when you have the word Trump, normally reasonable people, scholars, professors, academics, lose their reason. They just lose their reason. And they make the most absurd arguments, including some of my colleagues at Harvard Law School. One in an op-ed today in the Washington Post, Professor Lawrence Tribe, making the most absurd arguments that he would make exactly the opposite arguments of if the shoe were on the other foot. The Trump derangement syndrome has really impacted. Look, at Harvard, fired a member of Congress from the board of the Kennedy School because she dared to challenge the Pennsylvania and other votes, not on the ground that there was fraud, but on the ground that the Constitution doesn't permit the courts to extend voting dates beyond those established by the state legislature. She was right about that. Hey, Harvard, want to fire me? Want to take away my emeritus status? I agree with her on Pennsylvania on the issue of whether or not the state legislature could be overruled by the judiciary as to the time when ballots can be received and counted. She has a point. She had as good a point as many of the people on the left and among the Democrats did when they challenged previous elections, when Jesse Jackson, who was also on the same board at Harvard, challenged a previous election. He wasn't fired from the board. Adam Schiff didn't have his degree rescinded when he lied through his teeth many times on the floor of the Senate, including about me directly. And we're seeing that over and over and over again. Selective use of cancel culture by Harvard University started with Ron Sullivan, the dean of a college who was fired. All right, not renewed. Same thing because of who he was representing, Harvey Weinstein. This is a terrible time for the First Amendment, for due process. We're living through an age of the new McCarthyism, which brings me to the pardons again. A few months ago, I wrote a piece for Newsweek magazine in which I laid out what the power of the pardon really was all about. It's entitled, How Should President Trump Exercise His Pardon Power? And I make an argument, and an argument which I've made personally as well to the president, that the president's power of impeachment and, the president's power of pardon and commutation is not just an act of grace, the way it was in some countries, including England. It's not just the king saying, you, I pardon you, I don't. That's not what it's about. At its core, the pardon power is part of our system of checks and balances. Let me give you an example. This was the context in which I discussed this with President Trump. I have written extensively about what's called the trial penalty. I started to write about it in 1966, when I brought the first certiorari petition to the United States Supreme Court challenging the trial penalty. What's the trial penalty? You've heard about it before on the show. You'll hear about it again. I have an obsession with the trial penalty. The trial penalty basically says to every criminal defendant, look, you have two options. You can exercise your right under the Constitution to go to trial, but it ain't free. If you exercise your constitutional right to have a trial by jury, to put on a defense, all of which is guaranteed by the Bill of Rights, if you dare to exercise that right, and if you're convicted, we will double, triple, quadruple, quintuple, tenfold your penalty if you're convicted. Imagine if somebody said that to somebody who had the right to vote. You have a right to vote. But if you vote, we're going to raise your taxes. Well, yeah, that's happened. It was called a poll tax. It was ruled to be unconstitutional. You have other rights, but if you invoke them, we will punish you. But the trial penalty says that expressly, and the Supreme Court has affirmed it. I lost my case in the Supreme Court. I got three votes, but I lost my case in the Supreme Court, and the trial penalty persists. So I told the president about the trial penalty. We had a very good conversation. A number of people were on the phone, and he took it very, very seriously. He said he thought that it was really unfair. The cases we were talking about were two guys, white-collar defendants, who believed they were innocent. And so when they were offered 5 to 10 years to plead guilty, they said, no, we're innocent. We're going to go to trial. They went to trial. They were convicted. They lost. And instead of getting 5 to 10 years, they got penalties of 75 and 85 years, 10 times the amount. And when the president heard about this, he commuted their sentences, rightfully so. He did it not so much as an act of grace, but as part of our system of checks and balances. What he was essentially saying, and I'm just interpreting what I believe he was doing and saying, what he was essentially doing and saying was that 10 times is too much for a penalty. You can't take away a person's right to trial by jury by 10 times increasing the penalty. Look, the government believed that the crime they committed was worth 5 to 10 years. Government knew everything. They knew all the facts. What you did deserves 5 to 10 years. And then he did something else. They did something else. They went to trial. And that added the 70 years or 65 years to their other penalty. That's just unfair and it's unconstitutional. And I suspect and I hope that today we will see some more commutations based on the trial penalty, based on people who got excessive sentences. It's much like what President Obama did in the last day of his, the last week, really, of his term. He thought the punishments in general were too severe for drug offenses. He also thought they were racially discriminatory, that they had a disparate impact on African Americans. And so he used his pardon power as a check and balance on the failures of the judicial branch and the legislative branch. President Trump, I predict, will do the same thing today or maybe early tomorrow, I suspect today. And I think we'll see some examples of the trial penalty resulting in commutations based on the president's view and his power to check and balance that both the judiciary and the legislature are out of whack. The judiciary for allowing a person to be punished for exercising his right to go to trial, and the legislature for having punishments that allow 75 and 85 years for somebody who would normally get 5 to 10 years. So it's a very important part of the system of checks and balances, and I think the president will act on that. There are going to be controversial requests made of the president today. They have been made in the past, and I don't know how the president will act on them. I know that he has the cases of Julian Assange and Snowden in front of him. There are a big difference between those cases. Snowden stole secrets. He clearly committed a crime. Assange did not commit any crime, in my view. He's the New York Times. He's the Washington Post. He's the modern day internet version of classic newspapers. They print what's given to them. The New York Times and Washington Post published the Pentagon Papers. They published other stolen material. We now know that the New York Times reporter who just recently died, it was revealed he was complicit. He was complicit in the stealing. He himself did some improper things in the process of getting the story. And yet nobody went after the New York Times or the journalists. And so, you know, the case for Julian Assange is a strong one. I don't know whether it will be granted. I have been advising the Assange team on these matters, also on his defense and extradition. I met Julian Assange years ago when he was first being prosecuted. I went to London and met him in the office of his solicitor and barristers, and I established a lawyer-client relationship with him, and I still advise his defense team. So I'm not entirely objective on this. I advise them because I believe strongly in freedom of speech, and I put freedom of speech ahead of the harms that may be caused by the New York Times publishing the Pentagon Papers or Julian Assange WikiLeaks publishing material that the government would not want to see published. There's too much classification. We have overclassification in our government, and the public has the right to know. So, in the next hours, maybe by the time this show is aired, and maybe by the time you're watching it, the president will have given pardons. In doing so, he will be exercising his important power of checks and balances under the Constitution. Public has the right to scrutinize what he has done, but I know that he will grant many commutations based on considerations of justice, based on considerations that the sentences are excessive. He will be doing the right thing. Of course, people are petitioning him. That's their right under the Constitution to petition for relief. And of course, the fact that the president will give credibility to some people more than others is inevitable. Courts give credibility to some people more than others. Legislatures give credibility to some people more than others. I hope I have credibility with everybody, with the courts, with the legislatures, and with the executive branch. You earn your credibility when you have been credible in the past, when you don't cry wolf, when you don't ask for things that are unjustified. So let's see what happens today. Let's see how the president deals with his commutation power. Again, I think we've seen a lot of, speaking of crying wolf, a lot of that by the mainstream media insisting the president was going to pardon himself, insisting the president was going to pardon his relatives. Look, Bill Clinton pardoned his brother, and other presidents have pardoned people very close to them, political allies and political friends and donors and contributors. The power is unreviewable. If the president decides to commute or pardon, that's it. Nothing can be done. There was some indication in the newspaper today that the president couldn't lawfully pardon Julian Assange. That's nonsense. Of course he can't. He has the right to pardon anybody but somebody who is subject to impeachment. And even when somebody is subject to impeachment, the president can pardon that person, not from the impeachment, but from the underlying crime that may result in the impeachment. Because remember, the Constitution says that after a person is removed from office via impeachment and conviction, he can still be tried in the courts of our nation for crimes that he may have committed while he was in office. So we know that the president has the power to do that. But again, I don't think the president will exercise that power in terms of pardoning himself or his relatives or those who are very, very close to him. But if he does, it will be within his constitutional authority. As to anybody but himself, as to himself, we just don't know the answer. We don't know. The terms of the Constitution, the words of the Constitution would seem to suggest he could pardon himself. The policies would seem to suggest the other way. No person should sit in judgment over themselves. But we know that this is something that has never been tested in the courts. And so today, the final day, many people will be celebrating it as the final day. Others will be bemoaning it. We live in a divided country. We had many, many, many millions of voters voting for each of the candidates. I personally wish the president-elect a great 4 years, just as I wished the president-elect in 2016, who I voted against, for 4 good years. I'm always rooting for the incumbent president to do a good job, because our lives and liberties depend on the president doing a good job, particularly during the age of coronavirus. The president should do a good job in making sure the vaccine is distributed widely and quickly. And I'm rooting for the new president. I admire many of his cabinet choices and picks. And so on the Durst Show, you'll be hearing in the future more about the new president and my evaluations of Joe Biden, who I've known for many years. You will hear critical assessments and you will hear positive assessments, just as you've heard it about the current president. I think it would be far better if, starting tomorrow at noon, the country could focus exclusively on President Biden, on his successes and his failures, on what he should do and shouldn't do on his first 100 days. I think it will be a tragedy if, during the first 100 days of the Biden administration, everybody is preoccupied with the Trump trial. That will hurt Biden. It will hurt the Democrats. And most importantly, it will hurt the United States. Let's move on. Let's remember President Lincoln. My God, he was in the middle of a civil war. More Americans had been killed than in any other war in the past and in the future. And what did he say in his second inaugural? With malice toward none, with charity for all. Let's move forward. Let's heal the wounds of the nation. That's what we should be doing. So let's end this impeachment, unconstitutional process against citizen Trump. Let's move forward and focus on President Biden. And today we will hear and see the last important acts, perhaps tomorrow as well, but mostly today, of President Trump. Today will be the end of a historical epic ending at noon tomorrow. And everybody has the right to judge that epic by their own terms. But the idea of putting a former president on trial is so inconsistent with American democracy. We've never done it before. We shouldn't do it now, because if we do it now, it will become the normalized part of our process. We will go after losing candidates, even candidates who have served their two terms. As soon as the candidate of the other party becomes president, there will be movements within the party, if they control the House and the Senate, to take vindictive, recriminatory action. That's not America. Let's move on with malice toward none and charity for all. This is The Dirt Show. Let's turn to your questions now with the wits that comprise The Dirt Show wits, the viewers and listeners. So let's turn now to your points. Let's turn now to our first caller of the day.
Professor Dershowitz, I have a question. Should this trial of President Trump go to the Supreme Court? Because, as you said, the Senate will not be able to act as a jury. And if it does go to the Supreme Court and President Trump's lawyers bring the receipts and they prove that there was election fraud, because now the new charge is that he incited the crowd because he talked of all this election fraud. And if the election fraud is proven, and will the witnesses be allowed? Because I did watch all of the hearings, and it was pretty compelling just by the people themselves, let alone the evidence from the Navarro report and other experts that came on. And election fraud it's proven in this court of law. What would happen at that point?
I don't think we will hear witnesses. I don't think there'll be a trial at all. But if there is a trial, I think it'll be more on the law than on the facts. And I'm not sure it would be the best tactic to try to prove that there was election fraud. I don't think most of the senators, even Republican senators, believe that. The vote was overwhelmingly against certifying the election. I think his strongest argument is his First Amendment argument and the jurisdictional argument. And my own view is it would not serve his interest to use the Senate trial as a vehicle for introducing alleged evidence. I think that belongs in the courts of law. They've tried to introduce evidence. So far, no court, as far as I know, has found the evidence compelling. Some courts have refused to listen to the evidence. My own view is there should be what I call a VIP, the voter integrity panel, where all these issues could come before a series of experts, people who are nonpartisan, people who are experts in computer technology and voting, people who are experts in demographics, people who have no bias. And so we don't have to believe either CNN or CNBC or Fox. We can listen to experts who have no horse in the race and at least take seriously their claims. I don't think the Senate is the right vehicle for having a trial about the election. Our next caller.
Hey, Mark Pasterek in Colorado. Okay, if the as the Congress did, they impeached the president, and if it comes out that the majority of the people who broke into the Capitol were people who were trying to embarrass the president or hurt the president, these are people like Antifa or whatnot, does the president, after his term, have some recourse to sue the government for the damage that's been done to him? Thank you. Bye.
Two answers. Number one, the second one first. President does not have the authority to sue the government. The government is generally immune from such lawsuits. He would have to show extraordinary malice. Second, most important, I've seen no evidence that the vast majority of the demonstrators were anything but people who agreed with President Trump and went much beyond what he asked them to do. Remember, he asked them to protest peacefully and patriotically. He didn't tell them to break into the Capitol. He told them to go to the Capitol. He had the perfect right to do that. Many speakers, civil rights activists, suffragettes, union leaders, radicals on both sides, left and right, have urged people to go to the Capitol and protest. So I don't think the evidence supports the fact that the majority of them were there to embarrass President Trump. There may have been a few. We know one person has been arrested who allegedly has some connections to Antifa or other organizations. Look, Antifa is a terrorist organization. I completely agree with that assessment. I've seen them. They have threatened to disrupt my speeches in Berkeley and other places. They are an anarchistic organization that has no interest in democracy or freedom of speech. And I wouldn't put it beyond them to have done this, but there's no evidence that they have. So let's stick to the facts. Let's stick to the evidence and let's see what the evidence shows.
I'm Charles, calling from Texas. I'm calling with regard to the past impeachment, and I have been curious ever since the last impeachment as to why John Roberts did not dismiss the charges against Donald Trump on summary judgment at the beginning of the Senate hearings. The Constitution specifically says that a person may be impeached for bribery, treason, and high crimes and misdemeanors. And it seems to me, not being a lawyer, but it seems to me that they would first have to cite the statutes which Donald Trump had violated. Mm-hmm. There were no statutes cited, and where was John Roberts on that point? Additionally, where was the Trump team that was representing Trump at the impeachment trial? Why did they not request that John Roberts examine the charges and ask them to cite the citations that Trump had violated? And I don't believe they had any. There were no citations. I mean, there were no statutes that had been violated. None were reported. And if you could respond to that, I would appreciate that, because I think that's a very important point. Mm-hmm. It was never brought up during the first impeachment of Donald Trump. And I think we're seeing the same thing again. And thank you.
That's a great question. You're a great lawyer. You're absolutely right. There should have been a motion to dismiss on the ground that the articles of impeachment do not allege impeachable offenses. No such motion was made. And so John Roberts, the Chief Justice, really didn't have the authority to grant it because the defense didn't make that motion. My speech came closest to that. I did not mention the evidence in the case. I simply made a speech asking the Senate to acquit on the ground that no impeachable offense had been charged in the House of Representatives. So my speech was basically a motion to dismiss, and essentially it was granted. The vote was not to convict, and I was told that a number of the senators were influenced by my argument, which was in the nature of, there's no evidence required in this case because the allegations, the articles of impeachment themselves, do not allege an impeachable offense. This one is different because this one does allege an impeachable offense. That is, it alleges that the president engaged in an incitement to commit crimes. I don't think the evidence supports that. But on its face, the article may allege an impeachable offense, unlike the previous articles of impeachment. So the president's defense team will have to decide how to handle that. I suspect there will be a motion, but the motion will be in the form of lack of jurisdiction of the Senate to try a former president, but also perhaps a motion saying that there is no evidence cited that there was a violation of the statute, and in any event, if there were an allegation, it would be unconstitutional because the speech itself was protected by the First Amendment. Great question. If you were a law student, A plus.
Hi, this is Deborah from Florida. I have a question about the conviction or trial, rather, of President Trump. You're saying that they can't try him after he is no longer president. I believe that since he's leaving the presidency with indicia of the presidency, in other words, he's walking away with his pension, and he's walking away with $1 million a year for travel expenses and lifetime Secret Service, he still has some of the indicia of a presidency. So why should he not be subject to having his trial heard in front of the Senate, unless he wants to give all that up? That's my question. Thank you. Bye.
It's a good question, and it really raises a counter question. Let's assume hypothetically a president is impeached. Let's say Richard Nixon. Let's assume he hadn't resigned. And let's assume he were impeached, which he would have been, and there would have been a vote to remove him, which there would have been. Would that automatically deny him his pension and his travel expenses and his Secret Service? I doubt it. Certainly the Secret Service would still want to guard him. He would still be a former president, and he's still a target of enemies. So I don't know the answer to that question, whether or not if a president is impeached and removed, he loses all the indicia of the presidency. But the Constitution doesn't say that the criteria for impeachment or the consequence of impeachment is removal of the indicia. It's removal of him from office. So I think even if he retains the indicia, impeachment and a removal trial are not the proper ways of addressing the issue of whether he maintains his pension. You could be a lawsuit about that, but I don't think the Senate is the proper place to consider those issues. The role of impeachment and removal is to simply decide whether the person remains president of the United States or returns to the status as a private citizen. And since President Trump will become Citizen Trump tomorrow at noon, I think that ends the jurisdiction of the Senate. But a very good question.
Hey, Alan. This is Michelle in Los Angeles. My question is as follows. Representative Steve Cohen from Tennessee introduced the following on January 11th, 2021. H.J. Resolution 14 proposing an amendment to the Constitution of the United States to abolish the Electoral College and to provide for the direct election of the President and Vice President of the United States. Obviously, it will probably pass the House and pass the Senate and pass the President because we have a single-party federal government at the moment. Will it become law and abolish the Electoral College? Can you speak more about that specifically? And while you're at it, since there are rumblings about packing the Supreme Court and adding states, including D.C., Guam, Puerto Rico, would love to learn more about how this could actually happen and if there's anything in place to stop it. Thanks, Alan. Love the show.
Hey, thanks very much. Great question. So the answer is clearly in the Constitution itself. Let me read you. It says, the Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to the Constitution. So you need two-thirds, and neither House of Congress has a two-thirds Democratic majority. So I don't believe that that route to constitutional amendment will ever be pursued. There is another route to the constitutional amendment as well, and that goes through the states. There won't be enough states to do it either. So although if I were rewriting the Constitution from the beginning, I would probably not have an Electoral College. Remember that the Electoral College technically, could deny every American the right to vote in a presidential election. If every state decided that it wants its electors picked by the state legislature, they could do that. If they did that, I think that would result in the abolition of the Electoral College. No state has ever done that. It was a long time ago when one state, I think it may have been Colorado, picked the electors. But in modern history, we vote for electors. But there's nothing in the Constitution that requires that individuals have a right to vote for president or even for presidential electors. So you'd need to amend the Constitution, and the votes just aren't there. In terms of admission of new states, the votes may well be there. Generally, what's happened in the past years is that states have been admitted on a balance so that Hawaii and Alaska were admitted at about the same time because one was thought to be a Democratic state, the other was thought to be a Republican state. And I doubt that we'll see Republicans acknowledging that Puerto Rico or any D.C. or any of our other territories or places that are eligible theoretically for statehood will be made states because they won't want to see the political balance shifted. There are other ways, of course, of giving votes to the people in the District of Columbia. You can create the District of Columbia is in the Constitution, but the size is not in the Constitution. So you could create a new capital, which would just be the basic downtown area with all the federal buildings, and that would remain the capital of the United States. And then the neighborhoods, Northwest Washington, Northeast Washington, could be made part of Maryland, and the citizens could then vote in Maryland. There's something wrong, of course, with having people living in the United States who don't have all the basic rights of people who live outside the United States. Of course, there is a constitutional amendment which has given D.C. voters many rights of citizens, but I think there'd be a big battle about making D.C. a state because it would be an assuredly Democratic state, and Puerto Rico would almost certainly be a Democratic state. So I suspect there'll be battles about it, but nobody can predict the outcome. Great question.
I am interested if you would address Robert Barnes' contention that legislatures and the administrative officials in the five disputed states not only disregarded the legislature's rules as far as the ballots being the deadline of the ballots, but also they disregarded the legislature's rules regarding monitoring drop boxes, registration criteria, signature verification, and also so these violations were much more than 10,000 votes that you mentioned in your previous podcast, but possibly hundreds of thousands of votes. Thank you, and I'm very interested in hearing your comments.
That's a very good question. There are several different kinds of challenges. The strongest one was the one in Pennsylvania where the judiciary expressly extended the amount of time for counting and receiving ballots beyond that which was legislated. That probably would have won in the United States Supreme Court, but that involved only about 10,000 votes. The other challenges were much more complicated because the argument would be made, and might very well succeed, that the legislature delegated its authority to other bodies, to election commissions, to the courts, etc. And that is probably proper under the Constitution. That is, the legislature has the ultimate authority, but it can delegate authority to others. These would have been very, very complicated challenges. They were brought in front of the court. And then there was the third group that is challenging actual fraud. And the evidence just didn't seem to be there to support that. Look, history doesn't have a statute of limitations. And if people can come forward with evidence that would demonstrate massive fraud, computer fraud, everybody should have their ears open. History never closes. But right now, the evidence seems that the cases that raise strong constitutional issues didn't have enough votes, margin of victory to change that. And the ones that did have enough votes didn't have the evidence to support it. And that's why I think Congress voted the way it did. In any event, though history has no statute of limitations, the law does. And Congress validated the votes. And tomorrow at noon, there will be a new president of the United States, Joe Biden, who I've known for many years, who I personally like, and who I wish the best of for himself and for the people of the United States of America. Tomorrow, by the time you listen to The Dirt Show on Wednesday, we will have a new president, and we will have a lot to talk about here on The Dirt Show. So please, let's have your calls and your comments, and we'll continue talking about Trump and Biden and everything else in politics, in law, and in life here on The Dirt Show. An important part of The Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms. Everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.